Poetry about a sitcom may not be something you expect to find in literary circles, and furthermore, you may not expect for it to be good. New Zealand poet Hera Lindsay Bird upturned both of those assumptions with a poem published recently in the spin-off titled Monica, after Courtney Cox's character from the 1990s TV show Friends. The poem spins from lambasting the character to serious musings on the fleeting nature of love and relationships, and back again. Bird spoke to us from Radio New Zealand in Wellington about her use of humor in her writing and about her forthcoming book.
It's actually Thursday evening where I am, and it's Friday afternoon where you are. So
Friday morning, actually.
How is the future?
Oh, it's great. You know, I think the weather's going to be good for you tomorrow.
That's good to hear.
Nothing terrible has happened overnight, so you can kind of sleep easy.
Good. All right. That's good to know. Okay, so Hera Lindsay Bird in Wellington, New Zealand. You came to our attention through a poem that you had published on the website, The Spinoff, called Monica. Could you read that poem for us?
Yeah, sure. Monica. Monica, 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 Monica Geller of popular sitcom Friends is one of the worst characters in the history of television. She makes me want to wash my eyes with hand sanitizer. She makes me want to stand in an abandoned Ukrainian parking lot and scream her name at a bunch of dead crows. Nobody liked her except for Chandler. He married her.
We're going to have to cut away from the poem here, partly due to length, but mostly because there's a whole lot of language in the poem that we can't use on the air. You'll be able to read the full text online at the spinoff, and we're going to pick up at the very end of the poem here.
Often I look at the world, and I am dumbfounded that anyone can function at all, given the kinds of violence that so many people have inherited from the past, but that's still no excuse to throw a dinner plate at your friends during a quiet game of Pictionary. And even if that was an isolated incident and she was able to move on from it, it still doesn't make me want to watch her on TV. I am falling in love and I don't know what to do about it. Throw me in a haunted wheelbarrow and set me on fire, and don't even get me started on Ross. That's a marathon read.
It is a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I really love that. Thank you so much for sharing it.
That's okay.
One of the first things that strikes me in your writing here is that it does a few things I don't often see in poetry. It's very direct, and it's very funny. In another interview that you gave, I remember reading that you prefer not to hide your meanings behind metaphor. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't mind a bit of metaphor, and in fact, one of my favorite writers is Mark Leidner, who's from the States. I don't know if you know him. He wrote this really amazing book called Beauty is a Case They Gave Me. And so kind of him and Chelsea Minnis have always kind of been my heroes in poetry. And in fact, they use a lot of metaphor, but the kind of metaphor that I don't really like using is metaphor whose intent is to kind of hide meaning from the audience, or to make things sound intelligent but unclear. Like, I think good metaphor should really kind of illuminate meaning for people. So I do write with a lot of metaphor, but this poem is kind of train of thought.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You've sort of encoded the origin story for the poem into the poem itself. Can you talk about like how you began writing this?
I actually don't remember kind of sitting down to write this. I do remember, I mean, it is based on this did really happen. It wasn't something that I made up. It was a really weird conversation that I had in an Uber. I was in Auckland and I had just lost my phone, and I was on my way to my best friend's book launch. And then I just ended up having this really weird, surreal conversation about Friends with my Uber driver. It was kind of the only thing that we both had in common. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it must have just stuck with me.
And the places that you and the places that you go with it are it goes from this sort of absurd comedic conversation and like sort of train of thought to really kind of sort of devastating thoughts on, you know, musings on relationships and how they end. No, I really appreciate how that it sort of ties humor in with this sort of melancholy tragedy that everybody that befalls like pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, is it...
Well, you know, even I think that kind of the ends of relationships, even if they're devastating, they often are kind of quite funny and surreal, aren't they?
Yeah.
I remember my last horrible breakup kind of had a really long conversation about it for like 3 or 4 hours. And then we both just went through the Burger King drive-thru together. And I remember thinking, this is such a weird end to like a relationship. This is this is so bizarre.
It was funny. It ends here at the drive-up window. Is it natural for you then to use humor in your poetry? Or is that something that you've worked at and developed as your voice?
It's something that I always used to do. And then I kind of got a bit self-conscious about it. And I tried to write these really serious kind of Anne Carson-esque poems that didn't have any humor in them, but they're just terrible. Like, I just I remember reading I don't know if you've read George Saunders before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love George Saunders, and there's a really amazing interview with him where he kind of talks about when he got accepted into Iowa Writing School, and he got accepted on the kind of stories that we read of his now that are, you know, they're just kind of hilariously funny, but they also have this kind of great pathos behind them. But then when he got into Iowa, he decided that he was going to kind of cast that all aside and be the contemporary Hemingway. And kind of took him years of going through. It wasn't until like after he'd left his writing school and he wasn't having much success with his stories that he realised that the, you know, his initial mode of talking was kind of the thing he was most interested in.
Yeah.
So I think that I've like just kind of been coming back to that again, because I think that's just how I naturally write.
And it's not really often that I see a lot of humor in, like, used in poetry. Is that, what kind of reactions do you get from listeners and from readers?
I never know how much the poetry community in New Zealand really likes it, but I often get, like, one of my favourite things is people who kind of don't, like, people's mums like me, and people who have kind of come along to a poetry reading really begrudgingly often really like me, and I find that kind of quite fun and entertaining. I don't know. I think New Zealand poetry can be quite funny, and there are a lot of New Zealand poets I like, but by and large it is quite kind of quiet and domestic and a bit more serious. Mm-hmm. So I do feel a bit out of place sometimes, but yeah. All of the poets in America that I kind of have read the most of, they're all like hilariously funny.
As a poet in New Zealand, I mean, do you feel obliged to sort of try to represent like New Zealand to the poetry world outside of
because the great thing about New Zealand poetry is that you never have to represent New Zealand anywhere outside of New Zealand, because no one outside of New Zealand reads New Zealand poetry. I mean, it's true. I think that we've probably got one or two poets in this country that are kind of internationally known, but yeah.
Mm.
No, it means that we just kind of have this weird private ecosystem, which is kind of good and bad.
Well, I'm interested. What was it that first attracted you to the medium of poetry, and what is it that keeps you writing it?
I think it was just like I'd always written poetry when I was a kid. My parents were for hippies, and we had this like funny child poet in New Zealand called Laura Ranger, who kind of wrote this really precocious book of like poems about like the rainbows and the hills and stuff. And I think my parents thought, you know, Hera can do that. So I used to get kind of like incentives for writing poems when I was a child, which sounds so kind of Glass Family, but never mind. And then I kind of didn't look at it again until I went to high school and I was doing a couple of writing courses. But I had a really amazing teacher called Lauren Gould, who came over every year. One of the recent graduates from the Iowa Writers Workshop comes and teaches a holiday program at the International Institute of Modern Letters, which is like the writing school that I went through. And just the people she showed me just kind of made me realise that kind of what poetry could be, because I'd never read anything like it before. But I also don't like to be... a poetry evangelist. Like, I'm kind of aware that to write poetry in this day and age is kind of a bit, like, weird and archaic, and I'm definitely not one of those people who's, like, wanting to go around high school being like, hey, you guys, you should all get really into poetry. You know, people, you know, movies are great. Television is, like, probably where all the best writers of this generation are. I don't know why I like it.
I mean, you talked a bit about when you began writing poetry, like, you writing a lot of, you know, using a lot of humor in it and then falling away from that and then finding it again. Can you talk about, like, yeah, and I hate using this term, but I'm going to have to use it, it's like finding your voice.
The way that I think I found the voice that it kind of runs through my whole book is actually just by reading and kind of emulating a couple of writers that I really loved. And I know that's not supposed to be how invisible air quotations, finding your voice works. You know, you're supposed to kind of, I don't know, sit in a field somewhere for like 2 days and, you know, it'll just come to you like divine inspiration or something. But I kind of think that, and I've been saying this to my students recently, that I think that, you know, all language is kind of learned and inherited from the world. And I think that if you, like, it's a really good idea to try and like consciously steal and borrow and experiment, and let it all kind of like filter down into your subconscious. And I think that like the thing with explicitly writing in a bunch of different voices is that your own voice actually comes through a lot stronger because you become really aware of like your specific tics and like the things that you can't hide in your poetry become very obvious when you are using someone else's language. So I think that really the voice I've come to is an amalgamation of kind of my own natural speaking and talking voice, but also it's borrowed a lot from my favourite poets. And I think that you can kind of read them all in this book particularly.
You've got a book coming out in July. Yeah, tell us about that collection.
It's taken me like a really long time to do. I finished the MA maybe in 2000, and, which is like your MFA,
yeah,
kind of in 2011 maybe. And I got offered to publish my manuscript directly after that. And then I just kind of procrastinated for about 5 years. But most of my poetry is personal poetry. And sometimes I think it just kind of takes me a while for to have enough things happen to me that, you know, that I have, so that I have something to write about. So it's just kind of like a collection of the last 5 years worth of work, coming out with Victoria University Press. I mean, it's all just kind of pretty archaic, I meant to say eclectic collection
eclectic,
of personal love poetry. And maybe it's archaic, I don't know.
Hara Lindsay Bird, author of Hara Lindsay Bird, which is coming out on Victoria University Press on July 14th. Hara, thank you so much for joining us.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.